This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell are accomplished solo singers, and now you can hear them together, duetting on their new album, Old Yellow Moon. It's their first duo album, though they've known each other for nearly 40 years. In 1975, when Emmylou Harris recorded her first major label solo album, Pieces of the Sky, after the death of her singing partner Graham Parsons, she chose a song by a virtually unknown songwriter to open the album. That songwriter was Rodney Crowell, who Harris also recruited to be a guitarist and harmony singer in her backup group, The Hot Band. Though they've remained good friends, they've gone their own ways professionally, with great success. They've both won Grammys and had records that reached the top of the country chart. Harris and Crowell spoke with Terry last Thursday, and they began with the song from the new album. This is Here We Are, written by Rodney Crowell.
Did you say that you've been searching for a place you've never been? Well, here it is. Here it is. And you've been down there on the bottom and looking out for a friend. Here I am. Here I am. We both grown tired.
Emmylou Harris, Rodney Crowell, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back, Rodney.
And, yeah, thank you.
It's a great new record. Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
So tell us the story of how you first met in the 70s and, Rodney, how you joined Emmy's band.
Okay, well, I had been signed to Warner Reprise. They brought a great team together of a very, very successful producer, Brian Ahern, who had all those the great Anne Murray records. And I was, you know, a fledgling artist. Basically, I was signed because I had gotten a bit of notoriety singing on two Graham Parsons records, Graham, who had died in 1973, and I was signed in 74. And so I went up to Toronto, where Brian lived, and to listen to material and pick material. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I found out right away that I knew what I didn't like. And Brian played me a whole day's worth. We went a whole day through a pile of cassettes. And, well, he said, I've got one more thing, and I haven't listened to this yet. It's been sent to me, a writer that I signed, who I've not heard, but on the recommendation of someone whose opinion I respect. So for the first time, Brian Ahern and I listened to the voice and the songs of Rodney Crowell. And the first song that was on the tape was Bluebird Wine. And I just knew that we had struck gold.
So, you know, Rodney Crowell, when you and Emmylou Harris joined together in her band, was the music you wanted to play and the music she wanted to play similar? Or did you have to kind of find a way to get on the same page?
No. It was an instinctive thing with Emmylou and I, and it still is today, which really requires very little intellectual analysis of what we're doing. It very much comes from the very center of us. I, coming from a family, a background, you know, sharecrop farm, my mother and father were sharecrop farm kids, and in the part of East Houston where I grew up, the culture just thrived on the country music that came with Hank Williams and Lefty Frizzell. It was the soundtrack of that culture. So when I met up with Emmy and we started working together and she had her conversion to country music, I was just there, and the conversation just picked up right there. And it's where I came from, and it was a perfect meeting at the perfect time. And we never had to really discuss how to approach it. It was just like, what song do you want to do? It was that simple. You
know, we would say, while we were waiting for who were to become the full members of the Hot Band, you know, the James Burtons and Glenn D. Hardens.
This was your band.
This was the Hot Band that Rodney and I, you know, went out and toured for a couple of years, 75, 76, 77. You know, we spent the time sitting. I think I had a notebook with, you know, it was my teaching, my homeschooling myself with all these lyrics to things like Don Gibson's Sweet Dreams, etc. And we'd have two acoustic guitars, and we would just sort of sit on the floor, and one of us would start singing, and the other one would jump in, and we would just, okay, what are we going to do next? Just because we enjoyed the singing. But, you know, every generation has to reinvent itself poetically in some way. You have to bring something new, but it has to be something very real. And I think collaboration is a way, a lot of times, that happens.
When you first were in a band together, was the band like living in the same house as many bands did then?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Well, Rodney and I, Rodney, you were staying at the, we had rented.
We were living
this,
in the same house.
Yeah, we were. We had, Brian, our producer, had rented this crazy sort of 1950s Esther Williams swimming pool house up off of Coldwater Canyon. It was rented so that he could park his mobile recording truck called the Enactron truck. So
I slept on the floor.
Yeah. And actually, at that point, I was in a relationship with Brian, who I eventually married, and we have had a daughter together. Now we're grandparents.
I should mention, he produced the new album.
Yes, and he produced a new album. So we survived divorce. Life's too long to hold a grudge. And we actually, you know, some marriages just come to an end.
So when the three of you were living together for a while, and Rodney, you were sleeping on the floor.
Poor me.
We had some other Canadians. Let's see, we had some Canadian engineers, and he brought his wife and two young babies down, and yeah, I guess we were like a strange hippie commune, except, you know.
Interesting that we sort of had this hippie commune in the Bel Air Hills, and we started touring, going on tour with Elvis Presley's band.
Right.
Know, when Elvis wasn't working, James Burton and Glenn Hart and Emmy Gordy would come and work with us. And
right.
So we were, you know, we were these hippie kids working with these really high-priced musicians. You know, because Warner Brothers Records had decided
to bankroll it. They decided to take a chance on that first record.
Now, I know we've been talking about duets and country music. I feel like I can't wait any longer to play another track from Old Yellow Moon. And this is a song that maybe doesn't quite fit what we were talking about, but it's so beautiful. It's called Spanish Dancer, and it's a song by Patti Sciolfo, who's from the E Street Band and is married to Bruce Springsteen. And the way you sing it, Emmy, it's so, I just get chills when you sing it. It's so emotional. It's just like, the song is about a young woman under the spell of love who gives herself to a man who knows he may not feel as deeply toward her as she does toward him. And there's this sense of vulnerability and potential ruin in the song. And can you tell us why you chose it?
You know, I became a fan of Patti Sciolfo's album that this song is from. It's called Rumble Doll, and I believe it might be as old as 20 years. The album just absolutely floored me. Patti's voice, not all great harmony singers, which she is, are good solo singers, but she definitely is. She is an exquisite writer. She writes about the female heart, the poetry of being female, in a way that every singer-songwriter, female artist that I know loves this record. This particular song has been on my wish list to record ever since I first heard it. And I don't know, I just put it off and put it off. It didn't seem right for the project. And after a while, I admit, I thought, well, how can I, at the age of 65, sing "Oh Mama," you know, talking to my mother, which actually is still very much alive. And but it's universal, you know. It's that vulnerability that you feel when you know that you could fall, and you know how vulnerable, to quote you, that you are. But it's something that you cannot resist, and she just puts it in a way that is so beautiful, and the melody too. And I actually really love Rodney's harmony on it.
I do too. Yeah. So let's hear it. So this is Emmylou Harris with Rodney Crowell on the new album that they have together, Old Yellow Moon, and this is the Patti Sciarfa written song, Spanish Dancer.
Oh, mama, there's the Spanish dancer whose steps I follow when he comes near. The red dress of temptation over a long black slip of fear. Will I fall beneath the shadow of some broken cross? My arms emptied and all my treasures lost. Spanish dancer, throw my roses down for him. Across these beds of darkness, he opens his arms and gathers them in.
That's Spanish Dancer off Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell's new album, Old Yellow Moon. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell. They have a new album together called Old Yellow Moon. They've been friends for nearly 40 years, going back to when he played and sang in her backup band in the mid-70s. Since then, they've each won Grammys and had records that topped the country chart. Emmylou Harris gained recognition and her first real experience as a singer working with Graham Parsons in the early 70s, before he died of an overdose. Here she is with Parsons on the song That's All It Took.
Of your name and all my love for you burst into flame.
I've tried so hard to let you go, but look, I still tremble at your name. That's all. I'm happy, but they read me like a book. And when today I heard them say your name, that's all it took.
So my guest Emmylou Harris with Graham Parsons, recorded in the 1970s. And Emmylou Harris has a new album with Rodney Crowell, who will bring back for more of the interview in a little while. So Emmylou Harris, you recorded like a couple of sessions together, and before they were even released, Graham Parsons died of an overdose. Did you know that he was using drugs and drinking too much? Did you have any sense that this kind of thing could have happened?
I should have. You know, when I came onto the scene with Graham, he was trying to kick drugs, and he was drinking a lot. And I was a bit naive about all that stuff, and a bit in a cloud, I guess, in a way. I look back on it and think, You know, how could I have been so naive? But as we, after we finished the first record and we took it out on the road, he seemed to get stronger and stronger and better, like he was really on his way to some kind of recovery. So I was really completely taken by surprise when I got the phone call. And it was such a shock. You know, I think when you're young, in your 20s, you think you're going to live forever, and you think everybody you know is going to live forever. And so it was really difficult to absorb the news and to figure out how to go about dealing with this loss of this person who was so important to, you know, as a friend and someone who I cared about very deeply, but also so much of my life and music, which was so important to me at that point. He was like my teacher and my the direction and everything. So it was like all of a sudden the lights just were turned out, you know, and I had to figure out how to make my way in the dark.
So you say he was your teacher. What are some of the things you learned from singing with Graham Parsons?
Well, you know, I say teacher. He never told me to do anything.
Yeah.
There was a naturalness with singing with Graham, and of course I have the same thing with Rodney. But because at that point I didn't really know anything about country music, he just let me jump in and just pick whatever note I wanted and duet singing. You don't have to worry about that third part coming in. So you can kind of just sing basically an alternate melody, you know, because I was unschooled, and it just sounded right. And so actually, it was just singing all the time, not just on the records, but, you know, when we went out on the road. And he turned me on to the Leuven Brothers and that fantastic harmony singing, which, even though they were from Alabama and I'm originally from Alabama, I didn't have a clue who they were. And just by osmosis, I just developed this ability to hear the beauty and the poetry, the restraint that is in country music that gives it its power.
What did you mean when you said earlier that you learned how to sing by singing harmony?
When you sing harmony, you're not thinking about yourself. You're just paying attention to the other voice and that other melody. And it also requires, I'm using this word restraint again, but I think that's a really important part of country music. And I think as a singer, you must ultimately respect the melody first, and then you can go on from there. But it just seemed like I concentrated on the words, the lyrics, the melody, and you get outside of yourself somehow, and you just enter a different place.
So, Rodney Crowell, this is kind of where you enter the story in terms of Emmylou Harris's life. And Emmylou Harris, you said that, you know, you learned to sing through singing harmony. And Rodney Crowell, you became, you know, the rhythm guitarist and vocal harmony singer in Emmylou Harris's band. So, you know, you've both sung harmony, you've both sung solo. Although, Emmy, you said you learned to just, like, harmonize without really knowing how to do it, and so you just kind of made it up. I know that there are harmony singers who you came to really love and who probably really influenced you. You mentioned the Leuven Brothers. And I was wondering if you could maybe both talk a little about harmony and talk about some of the singers whose harmonies you've greatly admired and have influenced you, and maybe sing just, I know you have no instruments with you, but just sing a couple of choruses of something in a style of harmony that you particularly like.
You have to go with sibling harmony. So, you know, the Leuven Brothers begat the Everly Brothers.
Right.
Who really begat Paul Simon and Garfunkel.
Can I just back up and say the Leuven Brothers wrote a lot of, like, Christian songs and other songs, and the Byrds made a famous recording of a Leuven Brothers song.
I like the Christian Life, which is such a beautiful recording. And if I might say that, if you listen, you know, Graham was in the Byrds, but he was still under contract to someone else. And so even though he originally sang with Roger on that, they had to take his vocal off. But if you listen to the box set, there's a version where you can hear the ghost of Graham's, because he phrased it different. He phrased it more like the Leuven brothers. So anyway, that was just a little aside that, that I thought was interesting, but probably isn't. So do you want us to...
Well, for your listening audience, you can sort of trace sibling harmony and see how it made it into the popular culture. If you start with the Leuven brothers, who greatly influenced the Everly brothers, who greatly influenced John Lennon and Paul McCartney. I mean, you can hear it in the way those two sang together. Matching my voice to Emmy's voice when we're performing a song at night, it puts you in a place where the song, the melody, is more important than the attention you're drawing to yourself as a solo artist. And it's a great place to be on a stage.
Can I ask you to sing an excerpt of a Leuven Brothers song and do the kind of harmony that they did, and tell us why you like that style of harmony?
Well, this would be like being in an Irish pub, you know. They say, okay, so you're a singer, are you? Well, sing us something. We don't have any instrument, but we're up for it.
We'll try this. Let's see. A house not a home was a picture Satan painted for sweet little sister and me. Our daddy would frown while mother was praying. His heart was so hardened that he would not believe.
Oh, that's so pretty. Could you say anything what makes those harmonies so good that wouldn't be too technical?
I don't know anything technical about it.
Well, it's human experience, you know. As Emmy was talking about church earlier, one person singing alone in the night, that's a good thing, you know, and it has a certain sound. It calls out to you in the night. But then when there are voices raised together, there's some kind of joy that comes into it. And this joy becomes sweet and to be shared. And, you know, the culture we come from, when someone sings, we just naturally go to the harmony part. I don't think I could sing in unison with somebody.
Yeah, no unison, not allowed. Although, interestingly enough, occasionally the Leuven brothers, Ira and Charlie, on purpose would hit a unison note, but it was purely for the effect of jarring you, and then all of a sudden it split off into the harmony again. But, yeah, the Leuven brothers, of course, there was something about their voices, you know, that they had the same sort of blood and DNA running through their vocal cords, you know, even though their voices were totally different. When you get that sibling harmony, that's great. But, of course, I love singing with somebody else who's totally unrelated to me, because then you really are coming from different planets in a way. And so this third voice that you create is like nothing that has ever existed before.
I want to thank you both so much. I've really enjoyed it. I love the album. Rodney Crowell, Emmy Lou Harris, thank you so much. And their new album is called Old Yellow Moon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Emmy Lou Harris and Rodney Crowell speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. You can hear the entire interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. Stanley Kubrick's 1980 film The Shining, about a man driven murderously insane by a haunted hotel, is a horror classic. The new documentary, Room 237, which is a reference to a particularly haunted hotel room, is about fans of The Shining who are convinced they've uncovered the film's hidden meanings intended by the idiosyncratic director. Our critic at large, John Powers, has this review.
A while back, I went to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art to see its current show on filmmaker Stanley Kubrick. It was jammed with visitors poring over his letters, eyeing the dresses worn by the spooky twins in The Shining, and posing for photos in front of the sexy futuristic decor of the Corova Milk Bar from A Clockwork Orange. Although I was surprised at the crowd, I shouldn't have been. Kubrick is one of the rare dead directors, Hitchcock's another, whose work is still watched by those under 40. And he maintains a lofty reputation as a reclusive genius. When fans talk about his work, you always hear one word, perfectionism. Here was a director, the story goes, who thought about every single detail in every single frame. Legend had it that Kubrick examined every single print of his movies before he let it be released. In fact, it's not true that Kubrick always insisted on perfection. He shot his Vietnam movie, Full Metal Jacket, in England, which didn't look remotely like Southeast Asia. Still, his obsessive attention to detail has long made him an idol of cultists who scrutinize his movies for secret messages hidden in the wallpaper. Such fanatics are the subject of Rodney Asher's Room 237, a very enjoyable documentary about five Kubrickians obsessed with wildly different hidden meanings of his 1980 film, The Shining. Where you may think it's merely a horror story, remember that blood flooding out of the elevator? These devotees argue that Kubrick's movie is really about more than a writer going homicidally bonkers. For one, it's about the genocide against Native Americans. For another, it's about the Holocaust. Yet another says the film is Kubrick's admission that he helped fake footage of the Apollo 11 moon landing. By way of evidence, these folks point to all sorts of clues. From the presence in several shots of the Calumet baking powder logo, with its distinctive chief in a headdress, to apparent continuity errors involving misplaced chairs that, this being Kubrick, can't possibly be mere errors. They're deliberate. Here, the fake moon landing guy discusses an aha moment.
And I wasn't sure I was right for the first hour. I wasn't sure that I had actually, you know, I wasn't sure if I was blurring the line between what I wanted to see and what I was seeing. And then at about 58 minutes in the film is the famous scene where Danny's playing with his trucks and he stands up and he's wearing the Apollo 11 sweater with the rocket taking off. Then I knew I had nabbed it. And then I started watching the film with an intensity that I don't think I've ever watched a movie before. And every line began ringing true.
Listening to this, it's hard not to think that here are obviously intelligent people with too much time on their hands. The obsession with sweaters and moving chairs bespeaks some sort of interpretive disease in which one ignores most of a movie, the plot, the characters, the setting, etc., in order to claim that what matters is actually found in a poster hanging in the background. If Stanley Kubrick, a hugely powerful director, wanted to make a movie about the slaughter of Native Americans, why didn't he just make it, rather than hide his secret meaning in baking powder labels that almost nobody would notice? Still, it's too simple to call such thinking deranged. Kubrick really was the kind of artist who planted echoes and allusions in his films. He wanted us to pay devout attention. Besides, a fixation on small things isn't aberrant, since Freud and Marx has become habitual to look for the symptoms of the true meaning hiding beneath the obvious surface. You know how a slip of the tongue can reveal far more than what the speaker thinks he's saying. Of course, this brand of interpretation is an invitation to go off the deep end. In many ways, these Kubrick obsessives share a mindset with paranoiacs and conspiracy theorists, who also find patterns and details that most of us find minor, if not irrelevant. Such thinking isn't wholly imaginary, though. It usually starts with real, teasing facts. The image on Danny's sweater, say, or the conflicting forensic evidence from the 9/11 attacks, then weaves them into a grand theory, usually ignoring or bending other facts so that everything clicks together in a satisfying way. A clear meaning is found in what would otherwise be the disturbing disorder of life. Now, there's obviously far less at stake in Kubrick's film than in the Kennedy assassination, which is one reason why Room 237 is so much fun to watch. It gives us a safe version of the paranoid search for meaning to which we're all susceptible. And even as we laugh, some of the commentators notice details that really are quite striking, like the odd make of Nicholson's typewriter, a German model which serves the Holocaust theory, or the skiing poster in the background that looks like a minotaur. This in a movie that ends in a maze. While some of their interpretations strike me as nutty, others are quite plausible. Room 237 shows us that Kubrick really does load up The Shining with Native American imagery. And surely this has to mean something. Or does it?
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the new documentary Room 237, directed by Rodney Asher. On MSNBC Monday evening, our next guest, Chris Hayes, will premiere his new show, All In with Chris Hayes, making the 34-year-old the youngest primetime anchor on any of the major cable news channels. For the past 18 months, he's hosted an early morning weekend show called Up on MSNBC. But he's already a familiar face to network evening viewers because he's been a popular guest and frequently filled in for Rachel Maddow. Hayes says he expects the format of All In to be similar to the format of Up, long-form panel discussions in which the participants talk through several issues. In addition to his work at MSNBC, Hayes is an editor-at-large of The Nation and author of the book Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Chris Hayes, welcome to Fresh Air. So I love to hear what interviewers tell their guests before the show starts, like what kind of advice they give. So what advice do you give your guests about how to be a good guest for your show?
If this was in cable news, we would have a, we would brand this with a franchise called Shop Talk with Terry Gross, in which we talk about what we tell our interview subjects. So I have a whole spiel that I give to guests. I basically say these are the principles of the show. The first and most important principle of the show is that we are not on television. What that means is no talking points, no sound bites, no point scoring. You know, I really urge you to look at your time on the show not as an opportunity to get your message out or get your message across, but as to come and sit and engage in good faith with the other people that are sitting next to you. And then I tell them it's a conversation, which means the conversation is best if it is not routed through me in a kind of hub and spoke model, which is that if the person to your right makes a point you want to respond to, turn to the person to your right and make a point. Jump in whenever you want. I tell them they can ask questions, which is something that people rarely do on television because people feel the need to present themselves as experts, but none of us know everything about everything. And in fact, normal human conversation does not consist of a succession of declamations by individuals, but in fact, people ask each other questions. And so everything that I say before the interview is to try to get people in the mindset of forget the cameras, forget that we're on television, forget the commercial breaks. We are just trying to genuinely have a conversation in which we relate to each other like actual curious human beings.
So one of the things that drives me mad sometimes is sometimes a guest will come on the show and think, oh, it's public radio. I can relax. I don't have to speak in sound bites. And instead of speaking in sound bites, they'll make like 15-minute speeches, and which is not good either.
That's not a hint to me, right?
No. But do you have to also rein in your guests if they're – this is more shop talk. If they're talking like too long, what do you do?
Yeah, I interrupt them and I move things along. I mean, you can't be shy about that. I'm very aware while we're sitting there that we are on live television and that, again, every second of airtime is precious and that I want to keep the pace of the conversation going. And so if things seem to come to a stall, if someone seems to be going on too long, there's a bunch of nonverbal cues that I'll send them when I'm sort of looking at them, nodding my head with more vigor than usual, as in, okay, let's get to the point. Or I'll just jump in if it's stalling and try to push the conversation along. So I'm not shy about that. And people on the internet will sometimes get on my case for being too interrupty. But I mean, it is live. We can't go back into post and take out all the bad stuff and make sure that it snaps along at a good pace. We are there live in real time in the moment. And so if something starts to lag or stall, I just jump in and push it along.
So since you are live, would you mention a moment where you wished you weren't and you could have edited something out?
Yes, I will mention this moment, although I'm reticent because the subject of this moment is someone who I deeply, deeply love, admire. Wallace Shawn was on the show. The amazing playwright, also actor.
Yep.
And Wallace Shawn is an incredible person, but he speaks at a very slow pace. And he told me that going in. I met him, I think, at a party and said, oh, God, I have to get on my show. You're one of my heroes. You're Wallace Shawn. And he sort of looked at me like, I don't know if you want me on television. I was like, I want you on television. and then he came out and he started talking and he talked at the pace that he talks, which is a deliberate pace. And I felt that kind of feeling you might feel sometimes occasionally on live television where it's like you see in your head the image of the astronaut who's been untethered from the space shuttle floating out into the empty universe. And your head fills with this kind of wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah feel. And I, as it was going, and this is partly due to the fact that I speak very rapidly and my internal metabolism is very, very high. And his was quite low. And so the gap between us made me think that time was literally slowing down before my eyes. The great punchline to this is I was a little traumatized by it. And we we got all set. And we get the ratings 2 days later on Tuesday morning, and the ratings were great and no one left. And it was actually a really good little lesson. Just because you speak fast, are from New York, want things fast, that is not necessarily the norm or the appetite the audience has. And people actually were totally willing to sit and listen to Wallace Shawn, one of the most brilliant playwrights and writers of our time, speak with tremendous wisdom and insight and deliberation for a long amount of time and not run away from the television set, which was a really wonderful, useful lesson for me.
Interesting. Okay. So your new show on MSNBC at 8 o'clock weekday nights is going to be on opposite Bill O'Reilly. How much have you watched his show over the years?
I have watched his show very, very, very little. I will say this. I do not think I've ever sat and watched an entire – I'm positive I have never watched an hour of the O'Reilly show. I have seen clips online when something happens. You know, there are certain people I've discovered this phenomenon in my life as a television host at MSNBC. There are certain people who really like to hate watch things, which is to watch stuff that drives them bananas and tweet about it. I'm not one of those people. You know, obviously what O'Reilly does is remarkably successful from a ratings perspective. But I also think there is a tremendous amount of inherited wisdom about what works in cable news, some of which is perceptive and wise, and a lot of which is just not grounded in any real rigorous analysis or empirical analysis. And so when people say, well, you're up against Bill O'Reilly, it's really unclear to me. It's genuinely unclear to me whether that's true in any real sense, which is to say, if we are competing for the same pool of viewers. I genuinely don't think of myself as in competition with Bill O'Reilly or in relationship to him in any real way. I think of myself as having a relationship with the viewers, building a viewing audience that I have a relationship with and trying to grow that. I mean, believe me, I want as big an audience as possible. But the conventional wisdom about this being a competition with Bill O'Reilly is not necessarily accurate.
So you've had a few things that were said on your show up that were amplified and made big, you know, big news in the media, mm-hmm. and other shows were talking about what was said on your show. So give us an example of one of those and what it felt like to have a clip from your show be such a part of the news day. I don't know if you want to go with Robert Gibbs or...
Sure. Yeah, I mean, recently we had Robert Gibbs, who has recently become a MSNBC contributor, obviously was White House press secretary for a while and an advisor to the president. And he was on our show and we were discussing drones and the drone program. And we played a clip of him and his successor, Jay Carney, a montage of them not just denying the drone program, but refusing to even acknowledge it existed in this tremendously awkward way. And we played it to him and I just sort of asked him, how tenable is this? We all know the U.S. is operating drones. We know that people are being killed. Some of them are people that we have reasonably good evidence are members of al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-affiliated or jihadis, many of whom are civilians. How tenable is it to go up there and pretend that you don't know what everyone else knows? And Gibbs gave this incredible, spontaneous, honest answer. He said, one of the first things I was told when I was training to become press secretary during the transition was, don't say anything about drones. Pretend you don't know it existed. Don't even touch it. And as soon as I heard the word drones coming out of the mouth of the reporter, I went into an internal place of, I don't know what you're talking about. And that was a pretty startling admission. I think one of the biggest problems with the drone program has been this total lack of transparency. And not just lack of transparency. There's something deeper than a lack of transparency, which is genuine bad faith, which is to say everyone in this room knows what's going on. And you are going to pretend that you don't know what's going on, but we know you know what's going on. And Gibbs was very honest about that, and that got a lot of pickup, and it got a lot of subsequent attention. And I was proud of it. I thought it was a good moment of television because it was genuinely unexpected, which is always nice on cable news. And two, it was a material bit of useful reporting about what the administration's internal conversations and posture towards secrecy vis-a-vis the drone program have been.
So now you're getting your own show. Now you're getting your second show after having up mornings on MSNBC. When you started in television, did you get a makeover at all, like hipper glasses or a different haircut?
You know, it's funny. I encounter people all the time who think there is some great machinery behind the scenes of how making people look a certain way.
There often is.
Well, there are incredibly, incredibly talented hair and makeup people who work in 30 Rock who make everyone look good. But there was never any stylist assigned to me or anyone buying me clothes. So there was no real makeover. I mean, the thing that happens is, and it's a very bizarre experience, what happens is you start noticing that people are noticing how you look. And it is a profoundly alienating experience when it first happens, where you go on TV and you say something about some topic of the day, and on the internet people are like, what was up with that shirt? What was up with your hair? And you think, oh, that's kind of a bummer. I think actually as a man, it was a really useful tiny sliver of a tiny empathetic window into what navigating the world as a woman often is, in which looks are so foregrounded and so scrutinized and so discussed. It was really alienating at first. I think you get a tougher skin about it as you go on through it. But it is strange to have people pay such careful attention to your appearance.
Okay, so you mentioned really what people were saying on the internet, probably Twitter. So how closely do you pay attention to that?
I'm tempted to lie to you and say I don't, but I'll tell you the truth, which is that I read almost all of it. I think it can be really toxic and destructive if you let it be. I also think we've established a relationship with our viewers, which is usually pretty constructive. And people often will point to things that we missed, or sometimes I've actually had things I say corrected on air live by someone tweeting at me, and I see it during a commercial break and then send a note to the control room, and they verify that, in fact, I got it wrong, and we correct it on air in the next segment. And all of that is because of this amazing informed viewership and also wisdom of the crowd's effect. So there's real benefit, I think, to engaging and reading Twitter responses. There's also, you know, there's a lot of like really nasty things that people say that hurt your feelings. And if at a certain point I do worry about what it does to your psyche and your soul over time. If you get to the point where it stops hurting your feelings, if something vital and human and important inside you has died.
So during a commercial break, instead of like looking at your notes or taking a few deep breaths, you're looking at the Twitter feed?
Almost always, yeah. And sometimes...
Isn't that distracting, though?
I don't find it distracting. I actually usually find it pretty useful. A lot of times people have pointed out a question or an avenue of conversation that I had missed, which I find useful. A lot of times during commercial break, we just keep the conversation going too. I'm not sort of constantly on the Twitter feed, but no, I don't find it distracting.
One more question. There was an MSNBC commercial, you know, because all the hosts do like commercial breaks in which they talk about who they are or what they believe. And one of yours was you biking into work and. Mm-hmm. And can you still do that? Is your face too familiar for you to bike into work?
Oh,
now?
No, I could, except that, sadly my bike was stolen. So nice. That's actually the biggest obstacle to it. No, I mean, in some ways you're more on your bike. You have more privacy than sitting on the F train, you know, in which you're packed in with a bunch of other people. I still like, well, when I had my bike, I have to get another one. It's one of these items that lingers on the to-do list, and there's a lot of those these days with trying to get everything up.
Okay, so now I just have this image of you packed in on the F train and standing next to somebody who's very conservative but watches your show anyways, maybe hate-watches your show, and wants to argue politics with you. Does that happen?
Blessedly, that has not happened so far. I think, you know, that would be taxing for sure. One of the things about, you know, the balkanization of audiences in our current media environment is that 99.9% of the people who recognize me are essentially like-minded politically or watch MSNBC. So I've been lucky in that I don't have a lot of run-ins with people who see me, recognize me, and just want to run up and start arguing or fighting about politics. And that would be super, super lame.
Do you feel, you know, you mentioned the balkanization of politics. Do you feel that MSNBC is contributing to that in any way by being like, you know, the lean forward, the left-leaning cable channel?
I think it's much more a symptom of it than a cause. You know, my large sense is there is an audience that is polarized already that is, you know, that we are speaking to. I think it's not quite as neat as that, of course, because there is a relationship between the two. So I think sometimes our network is part of the polarization machine. But I also think that there's things that are good about polarization. I think people that believe that the Voting Rights Act is absolutely important and shouldn't be overruled by the Supreme Court should have a place to go where other people feel the same way and are pretty ticked off about the specter of the Supreme Court striking down this act of Congress. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, to bring it back around to this conflict question, I'm dispositionally conflict averse, but my politics relish conflict because I think, you know, I'm the son of an organizer, and, you know, what organizing is finding productive conflict and productive tension. And sometimes our Beltway establishment views conflict itself as the problem, as if politics would be better if everyone agreed or everyone got along. No, politics is inherently, inevitably, and inescapably about conflict, about people with conflicting interests, conflicting conceptions of the good, different things they want to see happen in the world. And so that's going to play out in all sorts of ways. And I don't think there's anything innately wrong about a universe in which there's a left media and a right media. In fact, you know, that has been the case for much of the country's history.
Well, Chris Hayes, thank you so much for talking with us. I wish you good luck with your new show.
Thank you. I can't tell you what a massive fan I am of your show, so thanks for having me on.
Oh, that means so much to me. Thank you.
Chris Hayes speaking with Terry Gross. Hayes starts his new MSNBC weeknight program, All In, Monday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.